Okay, so welcome everyone to the third of our classes on Jataka stories and on the ever fascinating topic, the irrational longings of women. So, last, in the first of the classes, we summarized about the Jataka stories in general and where they come from, what kind of functions they perform, and so on. And the second class we looked at a particular kind of story, a particular pattern or motif of story, which I'd identified when reading the Jatakas, about 16 versions of them. In particular, the last time we looked at the story of the crocodile who longed for the monkey's heart. And we told the story of the crow queen who longed for the food of the king, and I believe also the jackal who longed for the red fish. And we noted that there were a number of similarities and patterns in these kinds of stories. And so these were the ones which I identified as being of the low form of these, in that they dealt with fairly kind of low animals, jackals and so on, and the story itself was a fairly basic kind of animal or folk tale. So what I'd like to move, take a step up in the world today and to read through the medium ones. Of course, this analysis of low, medium and so on is fairly arbitrary, but just to give a general sense of how these things are pitched. And so we'll look at a few medium tellings of the tale. All right. So this one is the story of the Chandala, the outcast woman who longs for a mango. So the fact that now we're dealing with the human realm is one of the reasons why it's one of the higher or medium forms. But because she's a Chandala, of course, not a high level in the human realm. And also the outcome of the tale is mediated by honesty rather than through a trick, as in most of the previous ones. Okay, now, number 309. Jataka 309, the Chavaka Jataka. Now, the Buddha, while staying at Jetavana, told this story about the group of six monks. So anyone who knows the Vinaya knows the group of six monks, one of our favourite sets of characters from the Vinaya. Of course, having their mates, the group of six nuns. The story is related in detail in the Vinaya. So the actual text here is referring us over to the Vinaya for the story. Here is a brief summary of it. The master sent for the six monks and asked if it was true that they taught the Dhamma from a low seat while their pupils sat on a higher seat. They confessed that it was so, and the master, in reproving these brethren for their want of respect for his law, said that the wise men of old had to rebuke men for teaching even heretical doctrines while sitting on a low seat. Then he told them an old story. So this is the background. Now, if we turn to the Vinaya and actually have a look at the story which is referred to in the Vinaya, what we find actually is that together with most of these minor rules of etiquette, that the background story in fact is very formulaic, and all of the rules in that section of the Vinaya are composed in honour of the group of six monks who are just said to have broken the rule and blah blah blah, and then the rule was made. So in other words, that all of those stories are formulaic, and they're probably based on just the artificial creation of a formula rather than on any actual thing that the group of six monks might have done. Now, this particular rule, the translator of the Jataka here quite correctly gives a reference to the Manusmriti, the most famous of the Hindu Dharma Shastras, which gives the rule that the disciple must sit on a seat lower than his guru. And of course, that's what this is pointing to is the fact that this, of course, was a cultural expectation in the time that the teacher should sit on a high seat, or at least not sit on a lower seat. There is no rule in the Vinaya, so just so you're clear on this, that says that the teacher has to sit on a high seat. All right. On the contrary, of course, it's one of the rules of the vineyard that you shouldn't sit on a high and luxurious seat. But what it says is that the disciples should not be on a higher seat. Hence the regular attempts by my beloved disciples to put me on a higher seat than everyone else in the monastery, and my equally regular and predictable attempts to not be put on a higher seat. Okay. It was interesting, we discussed some of these things with David Milliken in talking about cults and behaviour of cults the other day, and he was saying that one of the things that he's noticed about cult leaders is that they put themselves on such a high pedestal, whether a literal or metaphorical pedestal, and that they come, when they're put in that kind of situation, I mean, not only do they of course have to bear all of the projections and so on of their disciples and so that the disciples are placing on them, but they also come to feel the weight of those projections more and more and more, and to end up in a situation where they're just kind of grumbling and complaining about their students all the time. And he said that he noticed this thing where the teacher actually had a very, very deep-rooted contempt for all of their followers, yeah, which comes out of this kind of dynamic. And I think that was a very, very insightful remark. And so this is one of the reasons why I think it's important that, yes, of course, there is a notion of the respect for Dhamma. The Dhamma teacher can sit on a seat that's a little bit higher than the others for the sake of teaching Dhamma. But that's only for the sake of teaching Dhamma. It's not for as a general statement. Okay, so there's nowhere that says, you know, more senior monks or nuns have to sit on a higher seat or anything like that. It's only actually at the time when you're teaching Dhamma.
Shouldn't it be in modern times? Shouldn't it be what's convenient?
Exactly.
Theaters, whatever is best to actually convey.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's just a rule of etiquette, which, as is shown here, is embedded in a cultural expectation, and which would be adopted for that. Of course, in most lecture rooms and universities and so on, the seats actually go up higher than.
But then again, like, say at Dhamma Loka, everything's up a little bit higher. Mm. But it's much easier, then everybody can see what's going on. If you see, it's just, I always just see it's convenient.
So
in Thailand, they have those things that look like mini beds.
Yeah.
With great big seats with cushions. And
yeah, and then sometimes big thrones and stuff. Some of them
get
really, you have to climb upstairs to get to them, and they're kind of fully enclosed and all of these kinds of things, the whole pulpit kind of thing.
So Bhante, is the construction in badly taught numbers do such and such, and therefore we should do such and such, is that one way in the construction way?
Oh, you mean like when the bhikkhuni rule was laid out? No, that's not formulaic. That's only an occasional thing. Yeah, I'm not aware of any other place it appears actually. Yeah. No, not in the same way. Not in the same phrasing.
Right.
Yeah.
That phrasing, even though it's poorly taught, diamonds on that's used frequently, isn't it?
That just as
not about the seats or the chairs.
The phrase of the phrase simply of badly taught teachings might appear, but not the construction that says even those badly taught religions do such and such, so how can we do otherwise? I'm not aware that appears anywhere except for that story of the first Garudama. Yeah. Okay, so here we go. Okay, once upon a time, Atite, in the past, in Banaras, when Brahmadatta was reigning, the Bodhisattva came to life as the son of a pariah woman, Chandala. And when he was grown up, he established himself as a householder. And his wife, interesting, the translation here, I'll just read the translation. His wife, being with child, had a great longing for the mango fruit, and said to her husband, "My lord, I have a desire to eat mangoes." Okay, that's the translation. Actually, the Pali doesn't mention anything about her being with child. It only mentions that and then his wife having the dohala, being one who had the dohala, which is the term we found last week, this special word used in these stories to mean the insatiable or unreasonable or irrational desires of a woman. she's longing for this mango, dohala.
So,
there's one or two times where it does, yeah. But it seems to be an assumption, yeah, that they've read into it. Yeah. But it's interesting that that's been taken that way. Have a desire to eat mangoes. My dear, he said, Bhadde, member of affection, there are no mangoes at this time. I will bring you some other acid fruit. Ambila palam. My lord, she said, if I can have a mango, I will live. If I do not get one, there is no life for me.
This seems to be
right. Okay, so alabamanaya me divitang nati.
This puts quite a bit of perspective if you were to assume instead of the word gopala, the state of being a child. That makes all the stories make a lot more sense. So rather than we say, well, I have this desire. But that word specifically means that desire arises when you were a child. It means that the story just makes more sense.
Why?
Yeah,
I know that.
No, just the way that the sentence is constructed and the way the narrative is constructed. So instead of it just popping out of the air, then it comes out of the reason, and also symbolically, it also has meaning because what we're working with here is what comes out of fertility, you know, what comes out of that mysterious creativity.
Is that more like a creative desire? Desire for everything? Well, it's like a dead fish because, I mean, like mangoes are such a... Not nowadays when you can get anything because you can air freight them across the world. But if you wanted to... If you were going to die unless you had a mango when it's not mango season, that means you'll die. Because... You know, mango season is just so short and specific and productive, and mangoes are so luscious. And
it's true, they are very seasonal, yeah.
And they're
yeah.
very, also they're very expensive.
Yeah, very seasonal. And that thing about her risk of the life, as we'll see in this story, it's very realistic, actually.
Does it say her life specifically, or a life?
No, her life will go. Right. My life will be nothing. Right.
Which is good.
Now, so he, being one of whose mind was bound up, literally, patibadha citto, okay, his mind was tied to her. In other words, he was infatuated, in love with her. Thought to himself, now where can I get a mango? Now, on that occasion, there was a mango tree in the garden of the king of Benares, which had fruit on it all the year round.
Holy mangoes.
Yeah, duva palo hoti. So, it is quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Where do you get a mango tree that has fruit on it all year round? Sorry? They would have been, if they're in Sydney. Where do you get a mango tree that fruits all year round?
In the Garden of Eden.
Garden of Eden, complete with snake.
Yes. The fruit of knowledge, all that stuff.
Uh-huh. So, you know, as soon as you hear that kind of motif, you're immediately moving out of the world of the king. In fairy tales and mythology, the king is always, or very often, this is something which is debated and in mythology studies and anthropological studies, but there seems to be a very common, if not universal, I think probably universal, divine dimension to kinghood. Okay, so that the king and the queen in some way are like a halfway house to heaven. And that's something which you see all the time. I mean, you can see it even in the ritual that surrounds even modern kings and queens. You know, like the king and queen of Eden. Well, that's in that kind of situation, it's become much more explicit that there's a religious dimension to it. But you know, I mean, even the Queen of England's still the head of the Anglican Church and so on. Very much so, yeah. And the kings and queens tend to be wrapped around with taboos, so they're actually highly tabooed. They're some of the most tabooed people in the world. And in extreme cases, the King of Thailand used to be very extreme in the taboos. I mean, he still is in many ways. But possibly the extremist form was in Japan, where the emperor was so tabooed, for example, that he was so pure that he couldn't be sullied by allowing the sun to touch him. So the sunlight was too impure. Yeah.
Did he get rickets?
Or to touch the ground, right? So he had to be carried everywhere above the ground, so he wouldn't be sullied by contact with the earth, and continually under an umbrella, so he wouldn't be dirtied by the sunlight.
The emperors of China, too,
yeah. It's very, very common that, I mean, the details differ, but the ideas are very similar. So, so here we have a perpetual fruiting mango, which sounds like some kind of divine fruit or something like that. Okay, so he's going there to try to satisfy her longing. So in a sense, he's transgressing from his ordinary realm, which as a chandala is a fairly basic kind of existence, and so because of her longing, he's now sort of aspiring to this very least royal and quite possibly magical and divine realm. So then in thinking to himself, he thought, I will get a ripe mango there to appease her longings, her dohala. Okay. Then going to the garden by night, Ratibhage, so this is of course the time of the unconscious. Then he climbed up the tree and stepped from one branch to another looking for the fruit. And while he was thus engaged, the day began to break. So, quite a big tree, I imagine. He's wandering around there at night time, yeah? Trying to find his mango. Sorry? Okay, so thinking, if I come down now, I shall be seen and seized as a thief. So I'll wait here until it's dark. Okay, so he climbed up into a fork of the tree and remained there, perched upon it. So one of the things that's symbolic about this is the fact that he's suspended between the earth and the sky. Yeah, he's out of his ordinary realm. He's somehow been lifted up halfway into the sky, which again is a symbolic of the divine realm. So this is in one of the classic motifs in myths and story tales and so on, is that you're removed from your ordinary context, where you have your ordinary expectations, your ordinary life, things go down predictable pathways, and then you're taken into a realm of the mystical or the magical. Suddenly, instead of spending his day sweeping the path or whatever he did as a chandala, he's there sleeping in a mango tree in the king's garden. Who knows what's going to happen? So you're in a realm where there's potential, a realm of potential. Anything can possibly happen from there.
Danger.
Sorry? And danger, yeah, of course. And the breakdown of your ordinary boundaries is very threatening, yeah? So he's have an uneasy kind of rest up there. Now this time, the king of Benares was being taught sacred texts by his chaplain. So the chaplain is the Purohita, and the word that they've translated as sacred texts is mantra. Okay, so this is the word, obviously we're familiar with the word mantra that we use in English today to mean a word which we repeat in meditation. But mantra in Pali and in the old texts usually refers not to specifically a meditation phrase, but more to just the sacred text in general. Here that the mantra is almost certainly the Vedic texts. The word, the mantra is usually used to refer to the Vedas. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, the way that we use the word mantra for a meditation word, actually in Indic, it's usually a japa or jalpa is what they use for that thing, like so, you know, repeating the name of Shiva or something like that. They're called jalpa or japa. Okay, so blah, blah blah, and coming into the garden, he sat down at the high seat at the foot of the mango tree, and placing his teacher on a lower seat, he had a lesson from him. Okay, so the king sitting on a high seat, and he puts the teacher on a lower seat. And I notice the word for a teacher is an acharya. Even though he's the king, right? So the bodhisattva sitting above them thought, how wicked this king is! Adamiko ayam raja. Okay, unrighteous. He is learning the sacred text sitting on a higher seat. The Brahman too is just as wicked, just as adamika, to sit and teach him from a lower seat. Okay, so this is how importantly this was taken, and you know, again, that's very much applicable within the context, and this is something that came up when I was a young monk in Wat Manachat, where for example you would have the monks would sit around and they might say, let's do a sutta class or something like that, and the monk who was reading the suttas would be sitting on a lower seat, and the ajahn would be sitting on the ajahn seat, and a lot of the monks, sometimes the ajahn, depending on who the ajahn was, would get off his seat so that the junior monk who was actually reading the suttas would be on a high seat, but then other ajahns didn't. Okay, so this is the basic point, is that when you're teaching Dhamma, it's not about who's the most senior, it's about who's actually, the respect is for the Dhamma, it's not a personal thing. So here, even if it's the king. Right, so the king's wicked, the Brahmin's wicked, and I too am wicked. I'm also adamika. For I have fallen into the power of a woman. And counting my life as nothing, I come in search of a mango. Alright. So there, that's the moment of realization, yeah? He's suddenly.
The dope.
So, coming down from the tree, taking hold of a hanging bough, he let himself down from the tree and stood before the two men and said, "O great king, I am a lost man, and I am one as lost. You are a fool, and this priest is like a dead man."
He's really just confirming that he's a fool.
I am Natha, means I'm destroyed. Yeah, Twang Mulha, bloody idiot. Purohita Mato, he's a dead man. The king said, reasonably enough, why are you saying that? He said, stop. He said the man appeared from the tree like Metabha appearing out of Narnia. Okay, so Sabbamidam. Okay, so obviously, you know, he's had this great realization, and it's pretty brave to do that. I mean, the king could have just chopped his head off right there, but as we see in the previous one with the crow, remember when they caught the crow, the king's first reaction was to ask, why are you doing this? You know, in a sense, he's faced with something which is so startling, you know, like, why? What the? And and so he actually does the proper thing, is to say, what's going on? So he says, what's going on, rather than immediately, whatever, killing him for hiding in the tree. The first verse, "Holy teacher and royal scholar, the sinful deed I saw, both alike from grace are fallen, both alike transgressed the law." Okay, it's not particularly clear that the verse says, what this something like what I've seen what you guys are doing, and in both of you I do not see the Dhamma. You've fallen away from the Pakati, which is literally from nature. You've fallen away from nature, and in the teaching of this text, both the one who is teaching the text and the one who is learning it. Okay. The Brahman, on hearing this, so just as a little textual note here, we've seen this is, we so far read out from the beginning, this is the introduction story of the past, this is the actual Jataka story as such, this is the verse. Now this little paragraph here is the word commentary on the verse. And these bits are not usually translated in the English translation. Okay, so it's just the actual story doesn't get a word commentary, only the verse gets a word commentary. Because only the verse is actually the canonical part. There's probably, I'm sure there's sub-commentaries that have the word commentaries and some sub-commentaries and so on. Okay. Oh, thunderstorm. Yeah, do you want to pop down? Did someone want to pop down the Nanskriti? Take five. We live on a ridge of what seems to be iron up here, so every time there's a lightning strike, our computers all get blown up. Hence the panic. It's already happened 2 or 3 times.
I hope Tash is alright. In her little meditating away, putting on her retreat with the lightning all around. That they get.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that it's the hard sandstone that has the iron.
Mm.
So that's the stuff which remains behind and makes the ridges.
This reminds me a little bit the story of the tree of the knowledge in the Bible.
In what way? Because
in the fact that the woman you have
itself is impermanent, but in a way it also it signifies rebirth as well, doesn't it? Yeah, because it's.
And when you're talking about the child, it seems like this energy which is child, the child that is coming in a certain moment, it's alive, it's really alive.
Yeah.
And sometimes one woman has been killed.
The interesting thing about one of the many interesting things about the Garden of Eden story, I read was at a conference. Some time ago, I'll pull it up now. But there's a really good. I can't remember her name now, but she did a terrific Genesis band. No, Genesis Bible. Bible.com. Really good. Where it's a really good analysis of it. Here we go. Because of course in Genesis there's two origin stories. The first one is the actually the later one, which is the one that first God made the heaven and earth, the earth was without form and void, darkness was upon the face of the deep. That one is usually understood to be composed in Babylon about 600 BC or so. And then the second one was the one with the story of Adam and Eve, which was probably the older one, and it's a kind of genuine mythological one. Yeah, and it's the story of the garden.
So is he actually the gardener?
Yeah, yes, he was.
But did you notice the parallels between the story of the Garden of Eden and the beginning of Revelation?
Which is?
Expelled from the Garden of Eden.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right, for disobedience, yeah? Well, that's actually, yeah, very good, yeah.
So what poem is actually the Garden of Eden?
Yeah, that's one way of thinking about it, yeah. So there was a great feminist analysis of this, and one of the things was that you don't actually have, like, it translates it always as man, he created a man, but it's actually not gendered in the original, it's actually just like a mud being, and it's not until they actually create the woman that you actually have the whoa man, and blah blah blah, and then they create it. But then another bit, which is also quite good, many interesting things, but when the serpent comes, the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature, so he's the cunning one, the wise one. He says, "Did God say, thou shalt not eat of any tree of the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." But the serpent said to the woman, "You will not die." So of course he's quite correct, because she doesn't die. "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and was a delight to the eyes and the tree was desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit and ate. So what the point was given here was that the woman wasn't just tempted by the snake, but she actually investigated by herself. Yeah, it wasn't just she did what the snake told her to do. She said, okay, well, it looks like good fruit. It looks tasty, yeah, and everything. And then when she gave it to Adam, she gave some to her husband and he ate. Right? No persuasion, no inquiry, nothing like that.
Happens every day. Sport at the time or something.
Yeah.
It's like the women want to practice.
Yeah.
And the moment that the women are given the opportunity to have it, and there's this reaction and there's an expulsion.
Yeah, well, we could try rewriting the Genesis. That would be profitable. That would while away a pleasant afternoon. Okay, so coming back to our story. So, interesting. Okay, so coming back to our story, the Brahmin's response to that attack. And just interesting little point here, that the commentary has an extra verse not translated in the... This is like an extra verse. This is still the word commentary here. And part of that word commentary, it includes a little verse. And the little verse is actually quoted from somewhere else in the Jatakas. Okay, so this is the Jatakas quoting themselves inside the commentary. And the verse here says that the Dhamma was the first to appear in the world, and then after the what is unrighteous appeared. So that's kind of interesting, and one of the things that it suggests, which is quite characteristic of Buddhist thought, is that goodness is actually the primary force in the world, yeah, rather than saying evil is the thing that appears first.
That parallels the whole God thing.
Yeah, well, first it was good, yeah? He looked on it and said, yeah, good enough for an alpha release.
Is this one for Buddha thought?
Look, that's just a quote from one of the Jatakas. Yeah. There are in the suttas some myths and tales of the past which also tell of a kind of a decline in some ways. So, but I think it more relates to like a Buddhist idea of human nature, which is that, I mean, of course the Buddhist idea of human nature is that humans have defilements and are capable of both good and evil. But I think that if you look at the overall teachings on human nature, actually most of the time that they suggest that people are actually tend to do good unless they have forces pushing them out of doing good. And it's not to say that, you know, people are always pure and virtuous and so on, but just as a general tendency. And I think that's true of people anyway. I mean, I think most of the time people, you know, people refrain from killing more often than they kill. Possibly, yeah. Because the human realm is supposed to be one of the good realms, yeah. Okay, so the Brahmin, hearing the rebuke of the outcast who's just dropped out of a tree, rather than saying, "Get out of here, you silly outcast, and what are you doing in the tree?" says, "My food is pure rice from the hill with a delicate flavour of meat. For why should a sinner fulfil a rule meant for saints when they eat?" Okay, so he's saying he's not keeping the rules which the rishis keep. Hearing this, okay, because the fellow he's criticised for being practising adhamma, what is not dhamma, and the Brahmin thinks that he's talking about he's eaten impure food.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he responds to that, you're not understanding the situation. So on hearing this, the Bodhisattva recited two more standards. Brahman, go range the length and breadth of earth. Lo, suffering is found the common lot. Here, marred by sin, thy ruined life is worth less than the fragments of a shattered pot. Okay. Beware ambition and overmastering greed. Vices like these to worlds of suffering lead.
Pretty strong words,
are
just sitting in the wrong place.
It is, yeah.
You became a philosopher, I think. Yeah.
This is one of the cases where the match between the verses and the story is not particularly close.
Mm.
So remembering, of course, that the verses were passed down independently from the stories and may be attached to different stories. So in this particular case, it seems that they had a thing where there's a Brahmin perhaps accused of doing something wrong and he's being defensive and so on, and then that was put into this story of the mango tree or whatever, but that they don't actually match up all that well. It's quite a common situation.
Kind of parallels the whole story of Moses and the Ten Commandments. The rule coming from, is it Moses? Yeah, Moses, yeah, coming down from high. Yeah, coming down from high up the mountain, up the tree, coming down with the word of God or the law or the truth.
Descending from above. Yeah.
To those humans down below.
But you could also understand that too, like such a strong reaction to sitting in the wrong place, that people over time interpreted the high seat as being incredible.
In a way, it's because it's setting up the thing with the high seat and the low seat is setting up a sense of cosmic order.
Yeah.
You know, you're saying good is superior to bad in the world by putting that in that way, and so by turning it upside down, you're actually inverting the cosmos. Yeah. Especially if it's the king, of course, because when the king's doing it, it sets an example for everyone else. Okie dokie. So the king, being pleased with his exposition of the Dhamma, okay, said to him, "What caste are you, my good man? Of what jati are you? What caste?" He says, "I'm a Chandala Deva." So the term of address for the king is Deva. Again, this is reinforcing the connection between the divine realms and the human realms. "Friend," he replied, "Bho," is the word he's using to say, like a term of address. "Satya, had you been of a high caste family, if you'd been jati sampanno, then I would have made you the sole king." Okay? "But henceforth I will be king by day and you will be king by night." Yeah? Now, this is very, very interesting because he's become the king of the night. Yeah? Yeah? the king of the unconscious. Yeah, he's the one who rules during the darkness. Very interesting.
It's also a common thing.
What is?
Well, having like alternate kings, like, isn't it?
Okay.
I think it was referred to in your one of your books, the one about the shoes.
One about shoes, yeah.
had,
I discussed him with different kinds of shoes worn by kings at night time.
Red, was it white diamonds?
And black shoes, yeah.
Black shoes.
It does happen, yeah, it does happen.
Was it red rot?
Something like that, yeah, it was, yeah.
Sorry.
There are various tales, for example, in Cambodia, you have what the king of fire and the king of water or something like that, and so you do have the substitute king. So yeah, this is probably the one that you're thinking of.
The one that was in Tibet. Was it not a king?
That's right, yeah. There's like this.
And somebody had to take his place. It got all very complicated, I can't remember.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
The one that took his place sort of like took on all of the bad.
Exactly. Yep.
The bad.
Yep. Yeah, this is this Fraserian motif of the substitute king.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a very common thing. I didn't bring Fraser. Probably don't have time to go through that, but yeah, this is one of the central themes in Fraser's Golden Bough, is the notion of the substitute king.
Because I mean, after reading your book, I went to Fraser and sort of read
the whole section, yeah.
Yeah.
So the basic idea is that often the king would be sacrificed after a period of time, and so some kings who were very pious would go gladly to their death, and there's actual records of this happening in India as late as the 16th century, where he actually sliced himself to bits in front of the audience with a sharp knife and bled to death on the stage. But some kings might be slightly less pious and dedicated to the cause, and so they use this notion of a substitute king. So they might appoint a slave. It could be another member of the royal family. It could be a slave. It could be an outcast, as in this case. And the substitute might be sacrificed instead of the king, or they might even just end up doing a mock sacrifice, like in the Christian ritual, where you just have a symbolic sacrifice instead. So it gradually gets watered down over the years. But this kind of motif. Possibly suggestive of that, yeah, where you have the Chandala appointed as the king of the night. But, you know, so that would be a social reading of it, but of course from a psychological reading, it's also very interesting. So then the king placed on the Chandala's neck the wreath of flowers with which he himself was adorned and made him Lord Protector over the city. Okay, so again, this motif of the wreath of flowers being a very important one. We find this in the Jatakas and so on again and again, that, say, for example, the condemned criminal will have a wreath of flowers put upon him. And henceforth, hence is derived the custom for the lords of the city to wear a wreath of red flowers upon their neck. Now, depending, and here it specifically says it's red flowers, Ratapupa. And I this is much more speculative, but I think it's justifiable to even read that motif as being a worn down symbolic suggestion of the notion of sacrificial. Regicide, killing of the king, because the red flowers around his neck are symbolic of the having his head chopped off. Yeah? So I mean, whether that's actually the case or not, it can never be proven. But this is when you see these patterns recurring again and again and again, you start to realise there's something more significant to it than just liking to wear a nice little flower. Okay. And from that day forward, the king, abiding in his admonition, paid respect to his teacher and learning sacred texts from him, sitting on a lower seat. And the Buddha identified the birth. At that time, the king was Ananda, and the Chandala was myself. Doesn't say who the Brahmin teacher was. So, and the wife has disappeared, yeah. So this particular one, Again, this is one of the reasons why I classified it as a middle one, even though it could have been regarded as a high one in the sense that he attained to kingship. So, but there's no kind of resolution of the whole motif. Yeah? She just kind of disappears. It's probably because it's being patched together from some different sources. So she's kind of disappeared from it. Nevertheless, it still remains the case that it was originating from her desire from the mango, which actually led to the establishment of righteousness in the realm. Yeah? And in particular, the perception and the knowledge of the night. Okay, so he became the king of the night. So it was from her wish and her desire that this is what brought the power to the night. And so again, notice that the story has could be read on all these different levels. But one, of course, the explicit, the overt moral of the story is, you know, you should respect the Dhamma teacher, and the Dhamma teacher should sit on a high seat and not a low seat. Right? That's the moral of the story. And so you can tell it simply as a tale, and that's all you're telling it for, and that's probably how it's usually told. Yeah? But of course, then all of these underlying things, which are also contained within the story.
There's a strong union motif as well.
Very true. And then that.
It could also be that it's the irrational, it's the irrational desire, this desire that has it's irrational, but it's got. It comes out of nowhere.
Yep.
Is absolutely necessary. So it's the sort of the mystery or the something that's. But thoughts that arise in the mind out of nowhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's necessary.
Mm.
It's necessary for things to happen. It was, you know, the source of. I don't know if that's the cat, or is it. Is the woman's. Sort of irrational desire to something that was sort of tacked on just to try and explain how this whole process started, or is it an integral, very important part of the whole story?
I think it's an integral part of the whole thing, and I think that's what emerges from seeing the pattern of the many stories which follow a similar pattern. If you saw it just once or twice, then you might think, oh, it's just a narrative device. But yeah, that power is actually the power of creation itself,
yeah.
which doesn't actually come from anywhere. It just appears in the mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And here, the men. I mean, that this might be a cultural thing, but it's what men did then and probably still now is that they're the sort of the agents for action that sort of carry through whatever.
Yep. She has a wish. She just wants, and the men are the ones that carry out the action. But just to come back to Jason's story before, but that it's actually very, the motifs are very similar to the actual the primary story in the Golden Bough of the priest of the grove at Nemi, and he also was like a king of the night in the sense that he couldn't sleep and he had to stay awake all night, and he was guarding a tree. He's very closely associated with a tree, it's very very close associations there. And those questions of integration that you mentioned is also very important, and something that you constantly find throughout mythology is that there's a sense of a separation, which may be a separation between the mother and father, or a separation between the sky and the earth, or the night and the day, and so on, and then a subsequent integration of the two. Yeah, and then he's in a way the medium. Yeah, he enables that to happen.
Mm. The outcast is the medium, which is
exactly.
Quite interesting. Not irrational, but the, the virus, or the whatever force it is that causes the change.
Just something like that, you're saying about the mysterious creative. And you can tell that I was using translated words here, but terms like the mysterious power, which refers inside the body to the Dantian, which is what is associated with the kind of between traditions between Buddhism and Taoism with the sex chakra.
Mm.
And the Dantian is implicated in the energy of the body, returning health, and also in fertility.
Okay, so I'll move on to another one of the medium ones. So the next medium one I've identified here is Jataka number 338. And so this is the Tusa Jataka. Let's see if I scan along here. This time we only find the story in the introduction, not the motif that we're looking at, only in the introduction, not in the story itself. It does have the word Dohala. This is one of the ones where actually occurs in the concept of conception. It's a queen, and the context is talking about King Ajatasattu. Now, this story was told by the master, by the Buddha, while living in the bamboo grove of Prince Ajatasattu. At the time of his conception, that's mean Gira. It's Gira. It's a very good word. Gira means it seems, or so it was said, or something like that. Gira. It seems that. So you always put in Gira when you don't want to be tied down too much. It's a very useful word for lawyers and things like that. Yeah. And in a sense, it just means Gira. Or Eva is the other one you use. Eva. Okay, living during the time of conception, there arose in his mother, the daughter of the king of Kosala, okay, a chronic longing to drink blood from the right knee of King Bimbisara.
The women are. I mean, we've got four right guys.
Right. Okay. I don't know if one would assume that, but one might hope that it does. Yeah.
Actually, the knees, a lot of knee dysfunctions relate to the sex chakra.
This have anything to do with AFL football? Are there knee problems?
Possibly. But seriously, on a clinical basis, I've seen time and again that knee problems are often associated with sex chakras. So here we are again, fertility, creativity.
How's your knee spontaneity?
Yeah, pretty crap. Pretty bad, yeah. I was just thinking that, yeah.
Not necessarily all
cases. Oh,
I'm Jason, you set it up, I just think it's too bad.
You guys are a team.
I just thought it was because the long bone and the femur is what contains most of the body, is where the blood is actually manufactured. That's my sort of feeling.
The right leg needs contraction.
You guys giving a high five. When we came out of the Parliament House the other day, there was all these school kids there, and they'll come up to me and say, "Oh, are you a monk or something?" And I was sort of talking with them, and then one of them goes high five. And I was just like so shocked, I just couldn't even do it properly.
It's not cool. It's like Spock from Star Trek.
I'll be ready next time, you know. But just at first, like, what the. What? I mean, I've seen Borat, but I still just couldn't. So, okay. Okay, the right knee. So, interesting that the right knee is mentioned here. Could have a number of possible implications. One of the possible, and just to suggest this, theories that one might invoke to explain this was a theory that was developed by Robert Graves in his book The White Goddess, and he argues that in many cases this notion of sacrifice of the king, the ritual regicide, was originally an act of regicide to the earth goddess. And as the sacrifice became worn down and substituted by lesser or symbolic forms, that in many cases it became, rather than killing the king, it became wounding or damaging the king, especially those parts of the king which are resting upon the earth, obviously the feet and the legs. And so, of course, you find many motifs in literature, Achilles' heel and so on, where the heel or the foot or the leg is the part which is connected with the earth and which is the part which is vulnerable. So here the queen longing for the blood of the knee could be understood as the queen longing for that sacrifice. It's just a possible explanation here.
So is this queen who's longing for the blood of a king, is it the one, is it her husband or a different king?
Yeah, her husband.
In medieval times, there would be that notion of bowing, healing for knighthood and that kind of thing, with building a right knee.
Mm-hmm. So just to clear this up, the question about the relationship, the mother is the daughter or the princess of the king of Kosala, who of course was Pasenadi in Kosala, Bimbisara being the king of Rajagaha. So she obviously looking at a royal marriage going on there. Okie dokie. So, anyway, she was being questioned. A chronic longing arose in her. The Dohala arose in her. Being questioned by her attendant ladies, she told them about this. The king too, hearing of it, called his astrologers, his nemitaka. Okay, so this is from the word nimitta. Okay, so nemitaka is the ones who can read signs. And said, the queen is possessed of such and such a longing. Okay. Devya kira, again the kira, it seems, evarupa dohalo, as is doha. What will be the issue of it? What does it mean? The astrologer said, the child conceived in the womb of the queen will kill you and seize your kingdom. Yeah? So again, if that suggestion I made earlier that this right knee drinking blood business is related to a ritual regicide, of course, then that sort of locks into the whole thing, because the son actually did kill the king and rule in his stead. If
this story is not something in the past, it's not the Bodhisattva then.
No, this is the story in the time of the Buddha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the Jatakas were all about Bodhisattva.
No, remember there's the story of the setting and the story of the present, which is always the story in the life of the Buddha. And then there's the story of the past.
This is just the setting.
So in this one, you can see here that's the setting.
Yep.
So it's quite an extended setting.
Yep.
Okay, so the king then says, well, what if he does that? What if he does kill me and rule him? I said, what's the problem? Ko etadoso. Right? Then he had his right knee opened with a sword, and letting the blood drop into a golden dish, gave it to the queen to drink. She thought, if the son is born of me, he should kill his father. What care I for him? And tried to bring about a miscarriage. The king, hearing of it, called her to him and said, "My dear, it is said my son will slay me and seize my kingdom." This being another classic mythic motif, and a lot of the Greek myths revolve around the idea that Zeus's son was predicted to kill him. "But I am not exempt from old age and death. Suffer me to behold the face of my child. Henceforth do not act in this manner." But still, she went to the garden and acted as before. Again, trying to bring about an abortion.
She went to the garden to do it.
Yeah.
She was picking poisonous
stuff.
The king, on hearing of it, forbade her visits to the garden, and when she had gone her full time, she gave birth to a son. On his naming day, because he had been his father's enemy while still unborn, they called him Prince Ajatasattu. Ajatasattu means unborn foe. Actually, it was used of several kings, and it seems to mean actually one against whom there is no foe is born, i.e. the invincible or the unconquerable one. But here it's interpreted in this way. The story that then goes on is actually the actual Jataka story is a very interesting one, but I won't go into that in too much detail because that will lead us a bit too far astray. The actual Jataka doesn't address the main motif that we're concerned with, but in itself is a very interesting story. So that one again is quite short, but it raises. Another whole kind of range of questions. For example, given that this one is at least supposed to be a story of the present day, in what sense does it actually represent people's behaviour? Which probably it doesn't, but an interesting perspective on that whole motif.
Would this on the story that followed, the actual Jataka, that would have been written first and then this
probably, yeah.
Because it seems, given the history of the Osiris killing him, that would have been invented.
It's probably been invented as like
to
a myth.
Explain it.
Yeah. Exactly, used as it's an etiological myth. It's a myth invented later to explain away things that happened earlier, and you know, probably using some very old mythic forms there. Okay, unless anyone has any more questions, I'll leave that one for now. Well, I mean, the story then goes on to say how when the child was born, and then later on the king brought him to visit the Buddha, and the king welcomed the child with a strong show of affection and placed him on his lap and fondling the boy with a natural love of the father of his child. So he's playing with his child so much when he went to see the he didn't even listen to the Buddha teach. Yeah. Sorry?
We just had the
that's just the background, yeah.
Yeah, so what's the
background? As I just said, the tale is a very interesting story, but it goes in a completely different direction, so it doesn't address the story we want to look at. So if you want to read that, it's Jataka 338, and you can have a look at that, but it doesn't bring up that motif anymore, so I'll ask if we can just skip that and move on to Jataka, 465, which is the next, the last of the middle ones. And again, this one appears in the introduction, not in the tale itself. Now, this particular tale is one of the is a very long, the actual introduction. This is unusual because the introduction you can see from here is actually several pages long, and the actual it's much longer than the actual story. Now, Jataka 465 is the Baddhasala Jataka. Now, the Baddhasala Jataka is actually a long and extended story telling the story of King Vidudava, or Prince Vidudava, who was the son of Pasenadi, of Kosala, so the sister, or perhaps half-sister, of the queen in the previous story, and how he conceived a hatred... he conceived a hatred for the king and eventually ended up killing him. This is the king Vasenadi, not king... Bimbisara, yeah.
What relation was he to Vasenadi?
He was his son.
His son, Vasenadi's son.
Vasenadi's son, yeah. This particular story I've summarised, it's a very well-known story, I summarised it in White Bones, Red Rod, but I won't go into the whole story here, but essentially the background and the of the story is the notion of caste again and the correct birth and so on. This is the basic background. Now, as one of the side stories of this that tale, okay, so we have the actual Jataka, we have the background story telling about the Jataka, and then we have another tale embedded in the backstory telling us about this where this motif appears. I'm just trying to find that.
Are these stories about the king's actually what happened, or just by what the people's family about what happened to the king?
There's probably a kernel of truth in them. It does seem that the general kind of social political pattern that we read about probably did happen, and likely these kings existed, and quite possibly they were killed and things like that. There are hints and suggestions, and some of these tales are included in the sutta. So, for example, the murder of Bimbisara by Ajatasattu is well found in the suttas and so on. So those things are probably true. But yeah, a lot of the details have been filled out later. Yeah, but generally the patterns of it probably are quite correct. Now, so this one will lose some context because I can't go into the whole background of it, but I'll just start with this particular sub-story, which is one we're interested in. Now, the king's commander-in-chief, this King Vasenadi's commander-in-chief, was a man called Bandhula. His wife Malika was barren. Malika here not being the Malika who was also Vasenadi's queen. Okay, so just a bit of confusion there. He sent her away to Kusinara, telling her to return to her own family. All right? So she couldn't have any children, so he says, get out of here, go back to your family. So she said, right, well, I'll go and see the paper sex to the Buddha before I go. She went to the Jetavana and greeted the Buddha. He said, where are you going? She said, my husband has sent me home, sir. Why? Because I'm barren, I have no son. If that is all, said he, there's no reason why you should go. Return. Interesting, isn't it? The Buddha's, confidently... Yeah. No, this is the king's general, yeah? Not the king himself. Return. She was much pleased and saluting the master went home again. Her husband asked her why she'd come back. She said, the Buddha sent me back, and the general said the Tathagata must have had some good reason. Okay? So soon later, Nachira Seva, she became pregnant. And then Upana Dohala arose. Okay, a craving arose. And she said, I have my craving. A craving has arisen in me. I mean, it's such a shame that we don't have a word in English for this, isn't it? Yeah. What do you want? He says a little bit nervously. And she said, my lord, I desire to go and bathe and drink in the water of the tank in Vesali city, where the families of the kings get water for the ceremonial sprinkling. Right? So these guys are from Kosala, which is to the west, and it's a different country than the country of Vesali, so they've obviously got this tank in Vesali where they do keep for the ceremony. That would obviously be a highly guarded ritual place, and it would only be used by the Vesali for their own sacred rituals and so on. But he says, okay, I will try, remembering he's a general. So seizing his bow as strong as 1,000 bows, okay, sahasa tamadhanum, he put his wife in a chariot and left Savati and drove his chariot to Vaisali. So he was starting to get more into more familiar hero territory. Chariots and bows and stuff. So on that occasion, there lived close to the gate a lichavi named Mahali, who had been educated by the same teacher as the king of Kosala's general, Bandula. Okay, so they had the same teacher. This man was blind and used to advise the lichavis on all matters temporal and spiritual. Okay, so the blind seer being yet another classic mythic motif. Hearing the clatter of the chariot as it went over the threshold, he said, the noise of the chariot of Bandula the Malian. Okay? This way there will be fear for the lichavis. So he was so perceptive that he could tell even from the noise whose it was. By the tank there was set a strong guard within and without. Above it was spread an iron net. Not even a bird could find room to get through. But the general, dismounting from his cart, put the guards to flight with the blows of his sword and burst through the iron network and in the tank bathed his wife and gave her to drink of the water. And after bathing himself, he set Malika in the chariot and left the town and went back by the way he came. So again, this is kind of idea of the impossible quest which he's overcome. Now, the guards went and told all the lichavis. Told all the lichavis, the ruling clan. The kings of the lichavis were angry, and 500 of them mounted in 500 chariots departed to capture Bandhula, the Malian. So the lichavis being an aristocratic government rather than a monarchy, it uses the kings in plural, the rajas. I'm just trying to find where the rajas are here. Yeah, that's it. Where is it?
Halfway
down to the left. Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. Lichavi Rajana, exactly. So this is the kings of the Lichavi. So just to note, as a usage, just to note that Raja doesn't really mean king as we have, but in this case you translate probably as rulers. Mounted in 500 chariots departed to capture Bandula the Malian. They informed Mahali of it and he said, do not go, for he will kill you all. So he was sabbe ghata. But they said, no, but we will go. Then he said, if you come to a place where a wheel has sunk up to the nave, you must return. I'm not sure what's the nave. The nave.
The part of the chariot.
It must be the, is it the hub of the wheel perhaps, or something like that?
Would it be the nave? Your belly button?
I guess so. Yeah, maybe the,
the
hub. Maybe the hub of the wheel. It's a part of the wheel. You must return. If you don't come back then return from the place where you hear the noise of a thunderbolt. And if you don't come back then turn back from the place where you see a hole in front of your chariots. Do not go past that point.
Yeah?
Yeah. But then when they came to a place where the chariot sunk down to its nave, they did not turn back. And when they came to the place where they heard the noise of a thunderbolt, they did not turn back. And when they came to the place they saw a hole in front of their chariots, they did not turn back. And then they pursued on and on. Malika saw them and said to Bandula, there are chariots in sight, my lord. Then Bandula said, tell me, when they all look like one chariot. Okay, so then when they're all in a line, one behind another. When they all in a line looked like one chariot, she said, my lord, I see it as it were the head of one chariot. Take the reins then, said he, and gave the reins to her hand. He stood upright in the chariot and strung his bow. The chariot wheel sank into the earth, nave deep. The lichavis came to the place and saw it, but did not turn back. The other went on a little bit further and twanged the bowstring. Then came a noise like thunderbolt, but even then they did not turn back. And Bandula stood up in the chariot and sped a shaft, and it cleft the heads of all the 500 chariots and passed right through the 500 kings in the place where the girdle is fastened, and then buried itself in the earth. They did not even perceive that they had been wounded. And they continued to their pursuit, shouting, "Stop! Stop!" Bandula stopped his chariot and said, "You are dead men, and I cannot fight with the dead." "What?" said they. "Dead? It's a flesh wound." Then Bandula said, "Loose the girdle of the first man." They loosed his girdle, and at the instant the girdle was loosed, he fell dead. Then he said to them, "You're all in the same condition. Go to your homes and set in order that should be set in order, and give your directions to your wives and families, and then take off your armor." They did so, and all of them gave up the ghost. So, there's a little footnote here. This is a variation of a well-known incident. A headsman slices off a man's head so skillfully that the victim does not know it is done. The victim then takes a pinch of snuff, sneezes, and his head falls off. Another form is two men dispute, and one swings his sword around. They go on talking, and by and by the other gets up to depart and falls in two pieces. So, but this, you know, also reminiscent of the champion feats of many heroes, and I'm particularly reminded of Odysseus on his return to the home, where he strung the bow that nobody else could string, and of course killed all the suitors of his wife. So then Bandula conveyed Mallika to Savati. She bore twin sons 16 times in succession.
Cool.
Hey.
That's really powerful water.
I remember that she'd been kicked out because she couldn't have any children. And they were all mighty men and heroes, and became perfected in all manner of accomplishment. Each one of them had 1,000 men to attend him, and when they went to wait with their father on the king, they just them alone filled the courtyard of the palace to overflowing. Okay, so then it goes on to tell more on the story and so on that we've leaving our own particular motif behind. So it's another interesting variation, isn't it? The same thing appears in so many different contexts.
Yes, that's quite amazing. I mean, the value of the creative, whatever it is, force, thing, irrational. You know, in this case, it was bathing in a special water before it might have been eating a mango, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but here, all those people died, and it's quite nice, I quite like. But, you know, in other tales, like, I've heard in your mythical tales like this, where they go off and fight and there's chariots and people get killed, but the prize here is seen so much more worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas in other mythical tales like that, I don't know, you see get a lot of people seem to get killed for not much, no reason at all.
Yeah. Well, that's quite characteristic in a lot of the Greek myths, especially. You know, you have quite a nihilistic thing. I think that's at the root of some of the nihilism that you find in Western culture.
Mm.
You know, that often everyone dies, and yeah, they do actually have a positive outcome in some cases, but it takes a long time to get there.
Greece.
Well, the thing is that in the case of, like, you know, Helen of Troy, that whole
exactly,
basically, it's not her create. It doesn't seem to be because of what she's, you know, capable of doing. It's just intrinsically her beauty or something like that. You know, prize, some jewel that people want to get.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's she needs to have this, you know, bark or whatever in order to be fruitful and multiply.
Also, what makes this in this story that was probably implicit in the other ones is the great love for the husband for the wife.
Yeah.
And his motivation, you know, to go through all the trials.
They're a great team. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, you're starting to get into this girl power kind of thing, aren't you? Yeah.
And because of the modern skin thing is also replicated in Greek stories through the oracles.
Yeah.
Rejected part of society.
Yeah, yeah.
Heavy
visions. Yeah. Was his name T.R.S. or something? The Blind Seer of Thebes?
Mm.
Yeah, he was a very famous character. And a very ambiguous character. He spent time as both a man and a woman.
As well as.
Yeah.
Probably very similar to
me. So he was called by Zeus, and Hera had an argument about who enjoys sex more, men or women. And so they called T.R.S. to come and give the decisive judgment on the matter.
Yeah, but he wanted to get rid of her. He sent her home because she was not fertile. Or he thought he was.
That's true.
That's true.
And then the Buddha said, "Well, no, go back."
Isn't there a rule where not supposed to interfere with?
There's a rule that you shouldn't be a matchmaker. It's a bit different, they're already married. The Buddha gives marital advice quite commonly. I'm just wondering whether we can get on to do one of the high forms of the myth for today.
They always come out second best in Buddhist stories.
Who comes out second best?
Basically.
Oh, yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
The part of the church, so to speak.
Was the second council was said basically, in all the versions. Yeah. Okay, let's have a look at one of the high forms of the myth, and we'll have a quick look at this for now, and then we'll go on to look at some of the more or these next one. And one that I'll choose for now as the high form of the myth is this one, Jataka 545, to just look at. Now, this particular one is one of the later Jatakas, and is a very long one, and we can't by any means even vaguely hope to do it justice. Very, very complex story, but I just want to, in this one, just again to just review the particular part of it which deals with the motif that we're interested in. So the background of this one is that praise of wisdom. Okay, so the monks are praising the wisdom of the Buddha, and the Buddha says, well, not just in this life but also in past lives I also had great wisdom. And so this is a story of a minister called Vidura Pandita, who was the minister to a certain king called Dhananjaya Kurabha in the city of Indapatta in Kuru. And the sage, according to the text here, bewitched all the kings of India by his sweet discourses on the Dhamma, as elephants are fascinated by their favourite lute. Okay. So we've got a so this one's 545 in the English translation, 546 in the Pali text. This particular story in the translation is, 30 pages long. A very complex story. But anyway, the wise man, and he did all these wise things. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, probably. Yeah, it's a standard list of kinds of wisdom. The great wisdom, various wisdom, profound wisdom, swift wisdom, laughing wisdom, sharp wisdom, penetrative wisdom. Okay, so a group of heavenly or divine kings and went to see this sage, the Garuda, Saka, and so on, and one of them was called Varuna, the Naga king. And when they had received the teachings from the sage, they were so pleased with him that they each gave him a gift. And the gift given by the Naga was a jewel. This is very typical of the Naga stories. Nagas are always the guardians of the jewels or the gems in Indian mythology. And in some cases is the all-seeing gem, as is, this, I think, appears in this story later on. Now, I'm just seeing if I can find the bit where we're at to. Then when the king Varuna came back and Vimala didn't see his jewel around his neck that he usually wore because he'd given it as a gift to the sage, he asked him where it was. He replied, "I was so pleased at hearing the teaching, the Dhammakatam, of Vidura Pandikata, the son of the Brahman Chanda, and I presented the jewel to him, and not only I, but Saka honoured him with a robe of heavenly silk. The king of the Garudas gave him a golden garland, and King Dhananjaya 1,000 oxen and many other things besides. He is," said the queen, "I suppose, eloquent in the law." The king says, "Lady, what are you talking about? It is as if a Buddha had appeared in India. 100 kings in all India, being caught in his sweet words, do not return to their own kingdoms, but remain like wild elephants, fascinated by the sound of their favourite lute. So eloquent is he." When she heard the account of his preeminence, she longed to hear him discourse on the Dhamma, and she thought to herself. So she said to herself, "If I tell the king that I long to hear him discourse on the law and ask him to bring him here, he will not bring him to me. What if I were to pretend to be ill and complained of a sick woman's longing?" Okay, so here she's lying down, she's Gilana. She has a tasame, "In my heart this dohara has arisen." So she gave a sign to her attendants and took to her bed. When the king did not see her, he paid his visit to her, and he asked the attendants where Vimala was. They replied that she was ill, and when he went to see her, he sat on the side of the bed and rubbed her body as he repeated a stanza. "Pale and thin and weak, your colour and form was not like this before. O Vimala, answer my question. What is this pain of the body which has come upon you?" She told him the following. "There is an affection in women. O Manujesu Matinam. There's an affection, there's a Dhamma in women. There is a nature of women," something like that, "the Dhamma of women, that is called, it is called a longing, Dohara. O monarch of the Nagas, I desire the heart of the sage Vidura." He replied to her, "You long for the moon, or for the sun, or for the wind. The very sight of Vidura is hard to get. Who will be able to bring him here?" When she heard his words, she exclaimed, "If I do not get it, I will die right here. Idheva maranante." So she turned around in her bed and showed her back and covered her face with the end of her robe. The Naga king went to his own chamber and sat on his bed and pondered how bent Vimala was on obtaining Vidura's heart. "She will die if she does not obtain the flesh of his heart." And notice that it's he who now introduces the Hare Mansang, the flesh of his heart. She just said, "The heart of the sage, Vidurasa Hare." How will I get it for her? Now, his daughter, Irandati, a Naga princess, came in all her beauty and ornaments to pay her respects to her father, and having saluted him, she stood to one side. She saw that his countenance was troubled, and she said to him, "You are greatly distressed. What is the reason?" And the king replied, "Irandati, your mother desires Vidura's heart, the sage's heart. The very sight of Vidura is hard to get. How can we bring him here?" Then he said to her, "Daughter, there is no one in my court who can bring Vidura here. Do give your life to my mother and seek out some husband who can bring Vidura." So he dismissed her with half a stanza, suggesting improper thoughts to his daughter. "Seek thou for a husband who shall bring Vidura here." And when she heard her father's words, she went forth in the night and gave free course to her passionate desire. Right, so I think she was looking for mangoes. I think that's the subtext here, yeah.
She's looking for what?
Mangoes.
Yeah.
I get it, right?
Okay, so she went looking for a husband. And then she gathered all the flowers in the Himalaya which had colour, scent or taste, and having adorned the entire mountain like a precious jewel, she spread a couch of flowers upon it. And having danced, she sang a sweet song. What Gandhava or demon, what Naga, Kimpurusa, man or sage, able to grant all desires, will be my husband the whole night long. Okay, so then the nephew of the great King Vesavana named Ponaka, the Yaka general, was riding past on a magic Sindh horse, 3 leagues in length, and hastening over the red rock surface of the Black Mountain to a gathering of the Yakas, a Yaka conference, heard that song of hers, and the voice of the woman who'd heard in his previous life pierced his skin and nerves and penetrated to his very bones, and being fascinated by it, he turned back on his horse and addressed her, comforting her, "O lady, I can bring you Vidura's heart by my knowledge, holiness and calmness. Do not be anxious about it." Okay, so she's won her champion to do that. Now, I won't go through all the details of the long efforts that Purnika goes to obtain the thing, but the basic means that he gets it in the end was that he finds a jewel in which you can see everything. I've probably got my stories right here. I'm just trying to check it to make sure I've got it right. Yes, that's right. This precious jewel in which you can see everything. All right. So the jewel which reveals everything in the universe. Okay. He finds this, goes on a quest and finds it, and then comes to the king and gambles it with the king. Okay. And they, because the king's addicted to dice.
Which king?
The king who's no, the king who has the sage. The king for who the sage is the advisor. And so he gambles with it, and the king being fascinated. Then it goes into quite a bit of detail about the different means of throwing gambling and so on. It gives the different names of the 24 throws in playing the dice and so on. So all of these details are given here. They do the gambling. There's various magical things. There's guardian goddesses involved, and so on and so forth. Finally, Punika wins the gambling context. Okay, this is again a common myth, a common motif in Indian stories. For example, Yudhishthira in the Mahabharata also gambles a kingdom at dice, and then he says to win, he'll win the best thing in the kingdom, which of course is Vidura, the sage. All right, is what he's going to win by gambling. And the king says, of course, I can't give him up. They go to Vidura. He says, I was won justly. I must go according to the Dhamma. And the that itself is a very interesting motif, I find, because what the stakes are. See, the stake is a gem that you can see everything, but what he loses is his wisdom. Yeah. So seeing everything is the opposite of wisdom.
Yeah.
Is the internet, yes.
Oh, I can't go any more with you.
That's what the mango is.
Not a mango version,
is it? Okay. No, calm down, everyone. Right.
So you've got this jewel.
Yeah.
Right, and that's being wagered between the king and the sages and
Punika, the husband of the Naga princess.
So the king gets the jewel and but loses
the stakes. So anyway, he takes the sage off. The sage then goes, visits his family, and gives a whole bunch of teachings to him, which is quite an interesting little advice. He gives a lot of advice, basically worldly wisdom advice on how to live and how to have a good life and be successful.
Well,
to his family and the people. After he's on his way back, he's going to be taken, but he pays a visit to his family on the way, and he gives this teaching. Finally, and of course he's, you know, completely equanimous to the fact that he's going to be taken off and killed and so on and so forth.
The sage.
Yes, the sage. Yeah.
Why is he being killed?
Well, they're going to rip out his. They want his heart.
She wanted to hear the Dharma, and then she said, oh, well,
she lied.
She basically lied. She sort of said, oh, well, she thought that her husband probably wouldn't buy that, so she made up this story about, you know, dying and if she got his heart.
It's a bit strange too, because yeah. His response to her request doesn't indicate that he's going to rip the heart out of the sage. That line, those two lines straight after that, her turning over in bed part, basically indicate that he's just going to grab the sage and bring the sage.
He says how to bring the sage there, but he also says she needs the flesh of his heart.
Yeah, that's afterwards though. It seems there's a bit of disconnect.
Exactly, and that's the whole the dichotomy the ambiguity that the whole story is based on. Yeah. So throughout the whole story, you're building up this expectation that what she wants is the flesh of his heart. Okay.
She
never said that exactly.
What she wants is
let's find out. Possibly the storyteller might have been aware of these ambiguities and might actually have been using them and might have them. Yeah, we'll throw dice, yeah. Okay, hang on. Okay, so they go through all these things and these battles and blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. Then finally he says, the sage Vidura Pandita says to Purnaka, the yaka who's after him, he says, you know, why are you doing this? What are you after? What's the thing? And then he says, well, I'm after this princess, and the princess told me that I had to kill you. Then the great being, the Bodhisattva, reflected, this world is being ruined by a thing being misunderstood. Why would a wooer of a Naga maiden want my death? I will learn the whole truth of the matter. Be not deceived, O Yaka. Many people are destroyed because something has been misunderstood. What has your love for that fair maiden to do with my death? Come, let us hear the... So then he retells the story and says that is this way of need of your death, if I that he needs to kill you and take your heart. Then the great being heard this, he reflected, Vimala has no need of my heart. Varuna, after he heard the discourse on the Dhamma and honoured me with his jewel, must have gone home and described my power in discoursing concerning the law, and Vimala must have felt a great longing to hear my words. Purnaka must have been ordered by Varuna through a misconception, and he, influenced by this, his own misconception, has brought about this calamity. Now, my character as a sage consists in my power to bring to light and to discover perfect truths. If Purnaka kills me, what good would that do? Come, I will say to him, young man, I know that Dhamma as it's followed by good men. Before I die, set me on the top of the mountain and hear the Dhamma from me. Afterwards, do what you want. And then I will let him take my life. So this is one of the meanings of wisdom, especially in the Jatakas, is this ability to infer. Okay, so his inference. He's heard what's happened. He figures it out, right? He knows what's been going on, all these misunderstandings and misconceptions have been happening.
It's interesting to me, Edgar Allan Poe's conception of Santa Claus. There's a few short stories, and he demonstrates all that, you know, when you talk superstitiously about people being on their minds, but actually they do the same, they look at the behavior of their
men. Yeah, yeah. Yep. And very short Holmesy as well. Okay, so then the great being says, look, I'll give you this teaching and then you can have my life. And he teaches, and then the Purnaka reflects afterwards, in making these four propositions, these four Dhamma teachings that he's given, the sage is only asking for his own life. Okay? For he welcomed me, though I was before unknown. I dwelt in his house 3 days, receiving great honour from him. I, doing this wrong, do it for a woman's sake. I am, moreover, in every way treacherous to my friends. So these are things, four statements that relate to the four teachings which the Pandita did, the sage did. If I do injury to the sage, I shall not follow the duty of a good man. What need do I have of the Naga maiden? I will carry him back to Indapatta and gladden the weeping faces of its inhabitants, and I will seat him in the convocation hall there. And then the sage then replied, O youth, do not send me back to my own home, but carry me to the Naga realm. So he's been given the chance to let go, right? The killer, Purnaka, has been transformed, right, by the teaching. So this is why this particular one was included in the high forms of it. And this is one of the characteristics of the high forms of the myth, is that the killer is transformed by the power of the Dhamma. Okay, so we've had this meeting between the sage as the man who's the embodiment of the male perfection, the wisdom, and then Purnaka is like the brute, you know, the killer, the hunter, and now the brute has been transformed by the wisdom. But he says, no, don't take me back, but take me where you're going to anyway, right? So he's been given a reprieve, but he says, no, don't take me back. And again, this is a motif we'll see in many stories next week. Because
he was a murderer, and then was, you know,
and he was saved,
yeah.
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 Okay, and then he warns him. He says, "I shouldn't take you among your enemies," and so on and so forth. Why do you want to go there? He says, "I've never committed evil. I do not fear the coming of death." And you know, you can see for yourself that I've taught such a cruel being as yourself, and you've been won over and softened, and so then I have the confidence that I can go to the Naga realm. And so then he goes and then has a Dhamma dialogue with the Naga king. Okay, and then has a dialogue also with Vimala and gives the various teachings and so on. Then the sage says that seeing that the Naga king and the Naga maiden were both pleased with his answers, then fearless in soul and with not one hair erect with fear, thus addressed Varuna, fear not, O Naga, here I am. Whatever use this body may be to thee, whatever it can do by its heart and its flesh, I myself will carry out according to your will. Okay? So he's offering himself up. The Naga king replied, the heart of sages is their wisdom. And we are delighted today with your wisdom. Let him whose name implies perfection, it's an allusion to Purnaka the Yaka, take his bride today and let him put thee in possession today of the Kurus. And so then Purnaka won his bride, and the sage was sent back to the to his land. So of course this is the resolution of the conflict and the ambiguity. The heart of a sage is their wisdom. And just to go on there, that morning the king saw a dream, and this is what he saw. At the door of the king's palace there stood a great tree whose trunk was wisdom and whose branches and boughs were like the virtues, and its fruits were the five sacred products of the cow, and it was covered by elephants and horses, and a great multitude with folded hands were worshipping it with all reverence. Right? So this is like the tree of life. Then a black man, clothed with red cloth and wearing earrings of red flowers and bearing weapons in his hand, came up and cut the tree down by the roots in spite of the protestations of the people, and dragged it off and went away. But then later he came back and planted it again in its old place and departed. Okay? So then of course he understood the dream, and then Purnaka came and brought the sage back. So this is again another very interesting variation, and this, I've missed out so many good things in this story, which really does deserve a detailed study. But the what we've seen interestingly relates to the story we read last week, doesn't it, where the crocodile was after the heart of the monkey. Yeah, remember we read that? Yeah, so in that one, because as a lower version of the story, it's less self-conscious. So everything remains in metaphor. Everything remains as a fable. This one is a very intelligent, highly constructed, literate one about intelligent, highly constructed, literate people. Yeah? And so it reflects on its own meaning, yeah? And it reflects on the nature of its own metaphors. So, and it brings out the implication that we had before, that the heart of the monkey was the its wisdom, its intelligence, its cleverness.
You also go a bit further than the other stories in the sense that before you had the union between the upper and the lower, and in this case, after the union between the upper and the lower, there was some type of a sage, that's not enough, there's still more to be done. And so there needs to be a union between the male and the female, and then it's
clear.
Kings, as an example here, giving up power for the feminine ritual.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that voluntary renunciation. You know, the king and the one with the outcast. He there was no need for him to give up his power, but he just did it. Okay, so this is, as I said, this is one of the high forms of the story, and we'll have a look next week at some of the other high forms of the story. And in the ones, as it seems to me that in reading this, that as we get further along, and as the story it's almost the meaning of it and the symbol of it comes closer and closer to the surface. And we've already seen that with this particular story, that it's starting to explain itself, when what the implications in those little animal tales that we read in the beginning, which you know, you might just be dismissed as nothing more than a simple tale, are now starting to actually become conscious within the story itself. This is one of the most fascinating things about the whole study of mythology, is that the study of mythology itself is the study of the human mind as it becomes conscious of itself. Yeah. Coming from a state of childhood and innocence, of not being able to reflect on those things, and becoming aware and starting to ask those questions. You know, what am I? Who am I? What's the true value? And so on.
Which also parallels the stories themselves, when you start with the irrational desire.
And so again, you know, just the outcome of this, even though, you know, her original wish was very ambiguous, morally ambiguous, it's dangerous, yeah? But it sets the whole thing in motion. And the outcome, of course, again, as before, is wisdom, fruitfulness, harmony. Okay, so let's finish up by paying respects to the tripwire.